was a silk.
Well, how do you remember the old, as a young child, how do you remember, you know, post delivery, your delivery of mail? Was it, you know, explain it to us. How was it?
Well, as far as I can remember, that the mail was always delivered very, very promptly. And I believe that it was a heck of a lot better than we have today. You see? And it didn't cost, as far as I know, years ago, it used to cost you 2 cents to send a letter anywhere in the United States. And boy, you've got prompt service. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have airmail and all that things. But listen, no one, as far as I know, everybody respected the mail, and no one ever thought of stealing any mail or anything like that. I never heard of anyone robbing the mail as far as done in this part of the country.
Except the train.
The Point Isabel Railroad was
a main railroad.
Held up one time, but that was they didn't hold. Was that a mail robbery?
Yes.
Or was it a shipment of gold or money?
Mail robbery. It was a mail robbery. That's why the United States sent those fellows to the penitentiary.
Yeah. Whatever their name.
In Detroit. Simon Garcia,
Mosquera. You see, they went to find out who had robbed the train. And there was a fellow by the name of Solis that lived at Point Isabel. The fellow's name was Timoteo Solis. He was also supposed to be a kind of a brave gunman. And when they asked Timoteo if he knew anything about the robbery of the railroad, he said, well, there's only two people that could do and pull a job like that. And he said, one of them is me, and the other one is Mosquera. He says, and I didn't steal. And I didn't do it. So he didn't tell off on Mosquera, did he?
No, he just accused him.
He just said he didn't. And there was only two guys that could. Would be possible to pull a deal, a robbery like that. Now, Solis was my father's uncle. Mm-hmm. Timoteo Solis, he was a brother to my grandmother.
Gomesino.
Fernandez.
Gomesino's
cousin.
Cousin?
No, cousin. Gomesino's first cousin, and my father's the one that told me the story. You see, that's how I need to tell you that he told him that there was only two people that could pull on a job like that. And that one of them was he, and the other one was Mosquera. So they went out to Mosquera's place, and then they found the tongs with which they had pulled up the spikes to wreck the train.
They found one of them. The other one they found out at the...
Out of by Raymondsville was a ranch, somewhere
no, way up this, there. No, this side of the arroyo, this side of Paso Real.
Paso Real, somewhere around there. He had the tongs made to pull up the rail system.
To pull the pins with.
Put them. And
they had it made at the Frau at Paso Real.
And they followed that and they sent them to the penitentiary. But that's about the only mail.
Brito was the sheriff.
Yeah.
He rode all over the country on horseback to piece the thing together. And they, but the third or fourth fellow, they never did find him. They didn't ever find all of the money.
He must have left and gone to
Mexico.
Yeah.
Simon Garcia and Mosquera died in the penitentiary at Detroit. Federal penitentiary at Detroit.
Now today, if those fellows could pull something like that today, under the ruling of the Supreme Court, now they couldn't have done much to them.
They'd go free.
They might have pinned the medal on them.
Huh? It wouldn't be against the law today.
And had this shipment, it was money that they were after
aboard.
And the one that gave the sail was a fellow by the name of Ramirez. And Ramirez, one of his sons, worked for a long time at the Frontier Lumber Company. You remember? Richard?
Yeah.
This fellow Ramirez was up there, and he gave the signal that everything was over, was on the train, and that they weren't pulling a robbery, that maybe they had, that the shipment was not being shipped on that day. It's something that there might have been a change of orders or whatnot. But other than that, I don't remember much more, as far as the railroad is concerned.
Approximately what year did this
between 87 and 90. Now, the people were highly respected citizens. They were citizens that would have never been suspected. They tell me that Mosqueda was a dignified, very law-abiding person. You'd have never thought that he would stoop down to pull or a thing like that. He had never been mixed up in any kind of deal like that before.
Yeah.
And, that's what made it a lot harder to trace. You see, and to have traced a man like him to pull the job like that.
Well, this bank robbery was a big thing. I mean,
in those days down here, it was a big thing. I can't tell you how much money was on it or not, but they wrecked the train and they took the money.
Where did they wreck this train at?
Well, at that time, it was only a narrow railroad that ran between Brownville and Port Isabel. And the longest it could have been was 21 miles, wasn't it? How many miles is it?
It happened about 11 miles from Brownsville and about 11 miles from Port Isabel. It happened right just the other side of the Mesquite thing.
You see, just a short railroad.
About where the port is now.
Approximately
how
much
money? Down, bro. What do you mean for
the Loma Trozada?
Loma Trozada.
Loma Trozada. You know what
I mean? That's right up
there. See, now to tell you how much money and all that, we would have to do some investigating on it and find out. It could be, we could, you know, check into it and find out. That's why I wish that maybe someone like Jesse, like Eddie Valente, and AA Champion could have been here.
They give you dates.
Well, they know more as to dates and all of that. Now, we never had many much of that.
In this train wreck, since y'all don't know the amount of money was taken, you know who was injured? You know,
I don't believe there was anyone injured.
Nobody was injured.
Well, as far as I know, I never heard of anyone
were injured. Were the bank robbers captured?
Oh, no.
Were the
no, they got robbers? Away. They got away. And, you see, after they got away and they got down to Port Isabel, they were checking and they were trying to find out if anyone had seen suspicious characters down there or not. And that's when they asked this Timoteo Solis, who lived in Port Isabel, if he had seen anybody, if he knew anything. And no, he said, "Well, do you have any idea who would pull a job like this?" He says, "Well, there's only two persons that I know that could do it. And I did do it." And that's how I come to go and get to Mosqueda, you see, who lived, I understood he lived in a ranch close to towards Rio Hondo, wasn't it?
That's why he got the fellow at Paso Real to make the hook for him.
And the fellow at Paso Real
made the hook at the flower there.
A blacksmith. Did they pull that belt of tongs? Oh, that's still fine. That's how I thought to catch up with him and found out that he was a guy that did all that.
The conductor of the train, Point Isabel, Brownsville train at that time, was a man by the name of Martin Kingsbury. And he was going on his regular run to Point Isabel. And his sister, Margaret Kingsbury, who later married Judge Forto and Sheriff Forto, was the only passenger. Except the crew, the engineer and the fireman and the brakeman. And when they started to leave Brownsville, this Tanilo, or whatever his name was,
from here,
wanted to go to Point Isabel. And old man Kingsbury wouldn't take him on because he didn't have any money. And he had ridden 3 or 4 times without paying, and that's why he didn't want to take him. So he started off on foot after the train left. So after they had stopped the train, they lost a lot of time at the Mesquite refueling and taking on water and things like that. That was one of the stops. They had another stop this side of it. And then they had another one beyond there. They started off again, and this fellow was going down the track, I guess, at a pretty good 5-mile-an-hour walk or something. And he caught up with the train, and the train was on fire. And he ran, and he opened the doors. When he did, Martin Kingsbury and the Mrs. Forton, Margaret Kingsbury and Martin, and the train crew came out of the boxcar. And they said that they had been wrecked. They had set the car at the back on fire, and they had locked them in the... They had set the passenger car on fire, and the fire was working toward where they were in the boxcar, locked up. So then they got word to Point Isabel was the first place that they could send to. Danilo and some of the crew took off there. Then they came back in a carretilla and picked up them, and then they started off with the deal of who did it. And a man by the name of Santiago Brito was the sheriff at that time. So he got what information he could, and he went to Mosqueda's ranch, and Mosqueda was not there. And they told him that he had gone off on a cattle buying deal with a man by the name of Simon Garcia. So then he went on to Paso Real, because he knew that it wasn't too far over there from where Mosqueda was. He lived out toward the Yescas. He went on to Paso Real, and there he found this blacksmith that said, yes, I made those tools for Mosqueda. So then he had him pretty close to the cutting of the fat. So it was a question then of just finding where they were and arresting them. As to where they were arrested, I don't know. But most of the money was never recovered.
How much money was it?
I don't know. $50,000 or so, I don't know. It was a lot of money in those days.
Did the bandits take it, or did they never?
Well, they weren't bandits. They were honest citizens. They just planned a way of getting some easy money. They had never become bandits before that time. No, nobody had ever known them to ever be amiss of the law. They were always all good law-abiding citizens. That's why it took weeks and weeks to road work. Old Brito, I guess, rode 200 miles in Cameron County back and forth getting his information until he made his arrest. He wore the front. And that's what gave these people that were locked up in the boxcar their lives, because by the time this fellow saw the train on fire, ching, I thought, and then he got out at a little dead run, and he went and he opened the boxcar. He wanted to get there quick, and he opened the boxcar and got these people out of there. The Miss Margaret Kingsbury, who after married Mr. Fortham, and her brother, who was a conductor, and the engineer, and the fireman, and there's a man here, Teodoro Solis, whose grandfather, whose father, had been for many years the man in charge of the roundhouse. And one of his parientes, a man by the name of Ayala, I think, was the engineer. Old man Hagstrom was in charge of the roundhouse. He took the Brownsville.
In Point Isabel.
The old family is buried in one cemetery.
My grandmother and this fellow that I tell you about, Timoteo Solis, was born in, they were born in Point Isabel in about during the 1830s to the 1850s. And Timoteo Solis was known as a man of a lot of guts. They lived out somewhere
I was out
in Point Isabel when they were my grandmother. She was already quite old, and she told me she was born. But she told me that the day had come in, that where they lived was out where the water was. I don't know how true it was, but that's what she told me. She said, we used to live out where the part of the bay came in, you see. And where she was born used to be dry land years ago. I don't know just how true she might be. She's quite old, but she told me that.
Don't put this. And he said, did you see anything unusual? Oh, he says, the other day my padrino was by here. He said, who's your padrino? My padrino, that's godfather, was Simon Garcia. And he said, they were in a hurry. And they were loaded down, and they gave me a silver dollar. And he said, if anybody asks you, you see anybody, just tell them no. But I don't know why my padrino wouldn't want me to tell.
Was that the one who played the sheriff?
Brito was sheriff at the time.
And he was laid out.
Brito, he was not a Mexican, he was a Guatemalan.
He was the outstanding
sheriff that ever had in this damn county.
He was Guatemalan, and he was raised by Henry Maldi.
But he was killed.
Shot in a damn hack down there on Market Square. Yeah.
Well, he had was shot killed. Just between... Right about in front of the Windsor.
I wasn't there.
Huh?
I wasn't there.
My mother told me that he was shot just down the street from where we lived. In front of where the Windsor Hotel afterwards.
I'll tell you something Roy Collins told me about.
He lived on the alley corner in the house where afterwards Hayes had a plumbing shop there. The house belonged
right next to the old fire station.
Right across the alley. Hayes had a plumbing shop there, right there, when he first came to Brownsville.
But I think
that's where Brito lived.
Now, Brito was killed. Why was he killed? Because when he, they tell me that when he found out that Tom Kennedy was going to run against him for sheriff, he decided to get Kennedy out of the way. So he got a fellow by the name of Esparza, who was married to a beautiful girl by the name of Elvira Limon.
Yeah.
They were having a big fiesta in Matamoros, and they were coming back over the boardwalk. They killed Kennedy. They say that John Kennedy, they said that Brito had Tom Kennedy killed to get him out of the way. So then he sent a fellow by the name here of Verdeo, did he?
Herculano
Verdeo. To come over here and kill.
But Herculano Verdeo didn't come over here. He was here. He was a Frenchman.
A Frenchman. But
he was the father of Frenchie.
Frenchie.
Amadeo Cavazos has another version of Mr. Tom Kennedy's death. And Amadeo's grandfather was Lino Saldana, who was with McNally for a while down there.
Uh-huh.
McNally had, the only Texans he had were Herman Brock, who was a Yankee, mm-hmm. Lino Saldana, Matias Serrata,
excuse me,
and Jesus Sandoval. And Amadeo's got a different version of Tom Kennedy's death. It was a feria at Santa Cruz.
A feria Santa Cruz.
Okay. And Tom Kennedy was over there with Esparza's ex-wife or whatever.
Elvira Limon.
Their marital status.
Elvira Limon, a beautiful girl.
And Esparza was a deputy of Santiago Brito.
Right. Yeah. That's correct.
And Tom just happened to be with this woman. Now, this is Amadeo's version from his grandfather. And there was some jarring went on there, and they began kind of standing off at each other. And Santiago Brito says to Miguel Tijerina, who was a compulsive gambler. Mm-hmm. He figures in this thing twice.
And Huescas died in Papantla, Veracruz.
Yeah. Miguel Jimenez was a real compulsive gambler.
Gambler, yeah.
And he said to Miguel, take Esparza over the river before there's some trouble here, and here we are over on the Mexican side, and we'll all be in a real jam.
Yeah.
Miguel said he would. He started for it, and there was a game going on around there, and Miguel stopped and plunked down a few bets. And in the meantime, Esparza was shooting at his ex-wife, so the story goes, according to Amadeo, a little bit irritated about these things, presumably, and he hits Tom Kennedy.
And he kills Tom Kennedy.
Oh, he didn't kill him across the river.
Didn't?
No, there we go.
There's another version. Where did he kill him?
Now,
he killed him at the big south tree that was on the boardwalk where the little crippled fella had his grocery store. Right across, he was the only one on the north side of the boardwalk. The other puestos were all on the riverside. And this fella, his name was, he had a grocery store last on the corner of 11th and Adams, right there across from the old Quereria of the Fernandez's.
11th and Adams?
Yes.
Had a grocery store?
Yes, sir.
Fausto Gutierrez.
Fausto Gutierrez had a store on the boardwalk. And it was a big south tree there. I mean a big one. A big one is this tree. Yeah, this tree.
South trees are willow.
Willow, south thing, same thing.
Well, south. I don't know, but some of these people, let's just take my mind.
I know that. The willow tree. And he is supposed to have come back. And he came back and was on this side of the river. And he waited for Tom. He knew he was coming. So the people came and he was in the dark over there. Tom was a very tall man and outstanding. He had been having an affair with his spouse's wife for quite a while, not just that day paying a little attention to him. He had been married to Irene Isnaga, and she died. They built the house that Babito Renfro moved out
right back of my grandma.
To
who died in
huh?
Right
yeah.
Back of she fell, as I understand it.
Back of
downstairs and had
yes, across the alley. The Plasma house.
Isnaga.
Yeah. Isnaga built that house. I mean,
Tom Kennedy.
Married Irene Snyder. And she died, and he had been having an affair with this Esparza woman for quite a while. And Esparza, they had a little bad blood. And they had this bad blood across the river. But like Joe says, let's get it out of here, let's get it on the other side.
So they came back, and his parson went over and he hid in the dark over by where the Missouri Pacific afterwards was. And when Kennedy came by, he saw him in the lights when they came by the garita under the faroles. And he went and got back to the tree, and when he came there, he shot him 3 or 4 times, and he ran back to the dark. And when the fellows that were on duty came to the boardwalk, down the boardwalk to be where Kennedy was falling, to see who it was, they found him, and this fellow just went around him and right down to the river
and went across.
Put the gun on the guy and said, "Take me to Mexico."
And he went back to Mexico.
And the story continues.
Then the story goes that John Kennedy, the audio,
Mifflin Kennedy. His father. Don Gregorio. John G. Kennedy.
John G. Kennedy wanted Esparza
killed. And he was killed.
And they accused Brito of getting Tom Kennedy out of the way so that he wouldn't whip in an election.
Here's another one.
Then they say that George Pute and Willie went across the river.
George and Frank.
And Frank, yeah. Went across the river and they killed. We brought the head of Esparza. And they took it, and they took it to the Gregorio when he
threw up his breakfast.
Georgie and Reggie.
Just record this off.
don't record that.
No.
Okay, and Sam Cobb were running for sheriff.
What year is this?
I guess in the late 90s.
Okay.
Let me start.
Actually, about 1900.
1900, yeah, the early 90s.
I know because I was looking up a death certificate and I ran over that the two cops with the body. And then a drowned body was brought over from Mexico who was one of the reefers. That's what I was looking
at. One of the who?
Reefers. W-R-E-F-O-R-D. Drowned on the schooner went.
You see, and it went aground on a storm, and
three men went around.
Got their stuff away.
Reefer, one of the Seamongs, and Joe LaRoche went ashore, dragged himself up in the sandhills, and died of exposure.
The captain was a fellow by the name of Anderson. The captain was a fellow by the name of Anderson. My father had just bought the schooner in New York in Orange.
Anyway, that's from the two
cars. First time it was Mickey and then the lot of
Well, anyhow, Reefer was that. Frenchie, the man we know, that was the janitor, was not raised by his father or his family. His mother was dead, and he was raised by a family by the name of Quintanilla, I believe. And one day he was at my house. He always comes to see me. He lives in San Antonio now. And he came to my house.
Still alive?
Yeah, he came to my house about 4 weeks ago. Not this last rainy cold spell, but the one before that. And I asked him if he remembered. He says, "I don't remember my father. I don't remember anything about it. They say he was a very rough, hard man." That's all he said. And French is a kind of a medio religioso fella. You don't want to push him too much about this. He just said that. But Alberto Estrada and a lot of the old timers that were here at the turn of the century always said that he was the one that had killed Brito. Brito had been drinking and had gone home, and then he went and got him and put him in a hack and then told the hackman that if he exposed who killed him, he would be the next one. So then when the Cobbs were running for you got this on now?
I sure do.
The Cobbs were running for city marshal. They were down right back of the Franklin house. Right back of where Eddie Valente lives now, one block down, across the street from the corner of a store called El Borrego. And there was a big drain there. And a fellow by the name of Carlos Guillen, who at one time lived on the alley corner of 12th between Elizabeth and Levy Street, right on the corner where the White Kitchen was. And he had a brother by the name of Luis, I think, a younger brother, a little fella. He was 12 or 13 years old. And my Uncle Jasper was sitting talking to his mother, who was very sick, and he shot
And Jasper was a kind of a violent man, and he ran out and he pistol whipped this kid. And Carlos Guillen came out and he said, "Lástima que no tengo yo pistolas, no nos amarramos." And he gave him the gun that the kid had. I don't know whether it was loaded or not. I guess he was hoping it wasn't. But he says, "There's the gun, and I'll tell you something. If you're here tomorrow, I'm going to burn you out and kill you when you come out of your house. I'll burn your goddamn house down." And they moved that night. They moved down to this valley over there. And this was at one of the polling places where the cops were killed. And he shot Samuel. And Samuel fell, and the younger brother, the 13-year-old boy, ran and got Samuel's pistol and shot him in the back of the neck or in the head someplace. And Felipe was in the ditch. He came running down the ditch, agachado, and somebody yelled at him, "Cuidado, compadre, ahí viene." And as he stuck his head up, Guillen shot him. He didn't leave. He stayed at the scene, but he was arrested and put in a hack and taken to jail. And on the way to jail, he passed where the parochial school is at the far end towards 16th Street or 15th Street. There was an old colored fellow there. I don't remember his name. But when Guillen went by, he said, "Me llevan a la cárcel, pero mañana sabrán quién mató a Brito."
¿Quién mandó matar?
¿Quién mandó matar a Brito? ¿Quién mandó matar a Brito? Ken mandó matar a Brito? And that's when Mike Wabisky and Rock and Old Man Reeford and Negro Abraham and somebody else stormed the jail and Paul Reeford, and they tore the gate down with an axe, and they went in and Mike Wabisky,
They
went in and lynched him, shot him full of holes. And old Mobisky wrapped him around the horn of the saddle and drug him out in the street.
And
old man Mike Wabisky.
Mike's father.
George Champion's father-in-law, senior, the old man's father-in-law. Old man George Champion's father-in-law. And they drug him out in the street, and old man Reeford was going to throw the kerosene on him, someone was going to throw the match. And old man Fields rode up in a buggy.
And Father Parasol.
This I got from Pancho Galvan, who was driving the buggy for Fields. And Pancho says that old man Fields would have his end of the gut too. And he had a whip in one hand and a pistol in the other. And he says, "The man that throws the kerosene, I'll whip him to death. And the man that lights the fire, I'll shoot him to death. I'll kill them both. But the first he's going to whip to death." The fellow that throws the kerosene on him, I'm going to beat him to death with this whip. He had a big chile toro, I guess, or something. Something you can make quick work of it. And then the fellow that throws the match, I'm going to shoot him. And it broke up the meeting. They picked him up and took him and buried him. But he was not buried with honor. They took him and buried him.
I'll tell you about that. Father was a city alderman at that time. He tells me that they were going to give him a big hero's funeral, but not, and they ordered that he be buried from the trash wagon. And they said the trash wagon picked him up, and they buried him right quick, early in the morning. They wanted to give it an afternoon, you know, funeral with a lot of bangs and whatnot. He was city alderman at the time.
His father would be over 100 years old.
He said at the time of the shooting and all that happened, Emilio Forte was sheriff at the time. He says he went out to a warehouse, you know, for say on Adams and 12. He went out of the alley. He saw the old man Forte running. In those days, the people wore Prince Albert's instead of coats, you see. And he said that he saw this, the Prince Albert's is going like this. And he called over the meeting. He says, "Where are you going?" He was running in the wrong direction. Lord Emilio was running in the wrong direction. He said, "I'm going to work for the fire." The shooting was, he was running this other way, you see. And he told, "Wait a minute." He said, "That shooting is over here." But then old man Kennedy went up to the Dodge City and bailed him out with money.
Yeah, that's what counts.
And that's what old man Kennedy tried to do with
that man by the name of John of God Grace.
Over here at Amarillo.
And not next
to our parents.
See, I was
Joe was about four.
I was 4 years old. We were in Point Isabel.
When did this?
My grandmother was up here. I remember all the commotion down there.
What happened? What exactly happened?
I was here, but I was too young to remember this.
It wasn't in the telephone. It was just the telegraph wire.
Let me tell you, I remember. I remember about the railroad coming in, but I don't remember about the stagecoach. I remember leaving here.
What year did the railroad come to ground?
1904. 1905 is when the first time it came in.
Well, they had the opening on July 4th, 1904. It was just
maybe one
train that went down in 1905.
The railroad afforded the dollars in it.
That's a lot older. That was in the 70s. Listen, I remember going.
Yeah, that was the song about the show. Yeah, but that's...
Wallace, I remember going to San Antonio, you see, and the train used to leave here early in the morning. It was still dark. I imagine around 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. And before these, there was two hack drivers here. One was Joe Guzman, who lived right there for Science House of Cleaners there on Adams Street. And the other was Federico Lopez. They were the two old standbys that we used to get hack drivers. There was no automobiles in those days, you see. No electric light. No water running through the town and whatnot. There used to be utilities, not even a wooden barrel, it used to deliver water. Well, this fellow used to come like that. He was mine, and would come in the morning and pick us up and ride to get to the railroad station. In those days, the train had carbide lamps. You could just hear a bird in the back to see it. I remember my mother used to get all dressed up and have to go to San Antonio, hat and whatnot. By the time we get there, man, she'd be dusted everything. But we'd arrive there and wait for the train to pull out. And then the train would stop at every varying place along the way to pick up freight, this, that, and the other. We'd leave at about, I'd say, 5 o'clock in the morning, maybe 4:30. And arrive in San Antonio about 11 o'clock at night.
Marcus?
He knows how.
What happened about that lynching of the...
They didn't lynch. They were tried and convicted and hung within a week by the time they were caught.
But what was the justice. Crime? What was these two men charged with?
They killed Mr. and Mrs. Austin.
Who were they? Who?
No, they didn't kill Mrs. Austin. They killed Austin and his son. And they wounded the old lady, but she recuperated.
And she testified.
And she testified and identified one of the men. Didn't testify. She identified him by voice to the authorities. They went out and arrested these two fellas. They had already arrested them close to Mercedes in that general direction going toward the river. And they brought him to Brownsville. And Sheriff W.T. Van was sheriff at the time, and Fred Wynn and Joe Longoria and a bunch of those fellas. They impaneled a grand jury, they indicted them. The judge came down from Corpus, I believe it was Judge Timon.
Hopkins.
Judge Hopkins, and he tried them, and they were convicted by a jury of 12 good men and true. And I think Frank Champion was the district clerk at that time. Bepi Webb was a county clerk, and they arrested these fellows, tried them, and convicted them, and hung them within 10 days, I believe. It was a very swift thing. The Brownsville was at the Cuates at Los Fresnos, I guess that, and the wrecking of
the train was at Black Bridge, sir.
Right there at La Una Salada, right there at Oklahoma Service Station.
Right. Just back this way from Oklahoma.
Now that was,
what about Black Bridge?
Well, that's further this way about
this
way.
Town.
They called it Nigger Bridge, but it was
Nigger Bridge.
It was south of La Palma, but it was further. It was about a half a mile north of there.
See, I'll tell you where that was. And I might be wrong, but what I understand about this kind of trouble and all this happened, my uncle had some land together with a fellow named A.B. Scott.
J.B.
J.B. Scott?
J.B.
The old shark fellow?
J.B. Scott.
J.B. Scott.
And Scott and Morton.
And they had this land over at around Los Fresnos.
And they along came some rangers, and they shot De La Rosa. It was De La Rosa and De La Peña. Who was the other De La Rosa?
Except for Pisaña.
Pisaña and De La Rosa, you see. They raped all their family, their fathers, went out and killed the guys that they had at the pumping plant and whatnot. They raised hell with the family. And that is what threw these fellows, De La Rosa and De La Peña, off their rock. They started out killing and whatnot. And after that, the thing seemed to pick up speed. They got more guys with them, and they finally wrecked the trade at Salt Lake, there by the Oklahoma.
Just
and that's
McKinney.
Where they killed Dr.
McCain.
McCain. And Harry Wallace was shot in the hand.
Where'd they find Harry Wallace? Where'd they find Harry Wallace?
Both the charge.
Dr. McCain and Harry both. Harry stood on the commode with the doctor in the corner, and Harry pulled him on the side, and
got him all in the arm.
Bandits came in there, as I remember the thing. It was in the smoke room, the pullman, and they asked, "Is anybody else here?" And some jerk from Point Isabel, I've never learned his name, was sitting there. He said, "There's two of them in there." So then they began riddling the door, and the boat hit there. And they shot Harry all on this side, and Dr. McCain was gut shot. The next morning, when I went out to school in the morning, this old army ambulance, mule drawn, came by the house, and I could see Dr. McCain, and Allie heard McCain, his wife, who was an RN, sitting there with him, and they went right on down the street someplace.
McCain?
Dr. McCain.
Dr. McCain, he was a state health officer.
That was no relation at all.
That's after that, you well, see, we had all kind of.
Outside
here
on which is being right now, it's 15th Street, wasn't it?
No, he lived.
Oh, that was Dr. Thorne. That was
Dr. Thorne. He lived next door to the Herald, where the Herald was on 13th, in front of Summers' furniture store in a 2-story house. Atkins lived in one, and McCain lived in the other.
Texas Rangers came here to Brownsville.
They were always here when I was a kid.
What'd they do? And what was the attitude of the people, the Texas Rangers?
They respected them.
Complicated story.
They respected them.
Why?
It's like everything limited. They had good rangers.
They had
bad. They had a few
bad ones. And things were different.
The bad ones created a lot of hard feelings with people and whatnot. They did a lot of atrocities and whatnot. They killed a lot of innocent people, you see. But there was many of them that were wonderful people and wonderful law enforcing officers.
And it got into politics.
But just like everything else, some were good and some bad. And they had a few that were bad, created a lot of ill feeling towards.
Were people scared of the Texas Rangers?
Yeah.
Why?
They were. Well, because.
Some of them were and some of them weren't.
What I've heard in Los Fresnos, in the Formigas and all that place around there, that's when the Rangers started up. And they just drove people off. Yeah. People just left everything in the houses
They were scared of it.
You know,
who was in the hauling of cans and everything else.
You know who was one of the chief guys that ran them off? 1915.
Well, that was during World War I. There were German agents just working the hell out of this thing.
This is the far.
They were signing those bastards. They were being paid by the
Mexican government.
You can read the Zimmerman telegram. Von Bernstorff was a German ambassador in Washington, and Zimmerman was in Mexico City. They caught correspondence between those people.
Listen, I'm going to say this.
They wanted to move them to stir up trouble on the border here so that it would take our attention off of you.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you something that happened. And that's this. The arrangers were set down. Some of them were fine. Some of them were not very good. J.H. Fernandez, the one that had the store right across from the market. All right.
Why not you?
There was a family here by the name of Silva. And there was a feud started somehow or other between the Rangers and Silva.
Seven.
Silva. Serna.
And they started killing, one started killing one, then one killing the other. And it went on until finally it got to the point where there was not many servants left. They killed the old man and the older brothers. And,
well, they killed some of them up the country and they came here.
And then finally.
And they lived in Matamoros. The old lady wanted the boys to go over.
They had the land here and they left the old man, Juan Ignacio Fernandez, as administrator of the estate, you see. And the last one of the boys that they killed was a fellow by the name of Logan. He was trying on a pair of gloves and one of these boys took a shot at it and killed him just like a shooting ducks in the barrel, you see. Not a way to get out of one. So then after that, they weren't satisfied with that. They decided they were going to kill J.D. Fernandez. And in those days, the people had the habit of going out on the sidewalk on afternoon. They used to lean against the building, see, like that, and these things passed by and they pulled the chair out for J.H. My next one. And why not just even try to put the fight in because he knew whether if he did it, they shot him. That's self defense. So it was but a short time after that. Right after that, he sent for my father. My father had a warehouse, which is on 11th and in Adams. And they had to go ahead and get a bunch of bad men in town together. And they could told him that he had to leave. J.H. Fernandez had to leave town. We were going to come and get him. I think they gave him 2 days to get out. So the old man Jesus Solis and a few of these Solises that were good money and whatnot. And they waited, and about the third day, there comes the Rangers. And they wanted J.H. So they said for the old man had a bunch of these fellas in the backyard of the old warehouse, and some over here at Juan Ignacio's place, J.H. And by the time the old man came down, he had all these fellas with guns across the street and all around, and he told the fellow, now let's get this guy. This happened. J.H. Fernandez had nothing to do with you. He's not going to be there.
Do you think that the Rangers were after, say, the Anglos, or do you think they were after more Mexican?
I think they got just after some
Mexican people.
I can't tell you what it was. But anyway, they got hold of old Jim Wells, and Jim Wells had them all taken out of here.
Right quick.
They got hold of Jim Wells, and Jim Wells threw water and went out. They moved the whole troop of Rangers out of here, and then J.H. Fernandez saved you. Otherwise, they'd have killed you. But they pulled out the chair from J.H. Fernandez that afternoon and they kicked him and knocked him around and went out. And then I shot him just as sure as everything, you see. Just because the old man.
Richard, I remember when the Rangers were out there in West Brownsville.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was after the war.
After which war?
World War
One. You're
thinking
about not Ranger Border Patrol.
War.
No, they were Rangers.
They lived in the house across from Charlie Smith, down the block.
That was Border Patrol.
I bet you my bottom dollar that it was Rangers.
Border Patrol.
Sure. How do you remember the Battle of Matamoros when you were much younger?
I was born in 1903, so I believe this Battle of Matamoros, the first one, was in 1913, I believe, when General Lucio Blanco came up. I believe he represented the Carranza forces. Later, President Carranza of Mexico was contending for the office, but wasn't in office yet. And Matamoros was held by the previous administration, possibly Madero's administration. I believe he is the one that succeeded Porfirio Diaz, didn't he, in Mexico? In any event, the battle must have started about the middle of the morning, possibly between 9 and 10 o'clock, and the shots were very audible on this side. At that time, my parents lived on the corner of 2nd and East Levy, and my mother and I and grandmother had been instructed by my father that when we heard any shooting, to get in the inner side of the house so that if any stray bullets came over, there would be no danger of us being struck. But instead, there was a three-story apartment house under construction. It stood for many years on the corner of First and East Levy, so the whole neighborhood proceeded to get up on the roof of that thing. The ladders were still there, the building hadn't been completed, and try to get some view of what was going on. You couldn't see anything to speak of on account of the brush. As I recall, this was in the summertime. I don't remember what month, but it's all in the old newspapers of that date. And the firing came quite thick and heavy, and every few moments one would hear a machine gun, just like you would hear in actual battle campaign or in the movies during a battle. That thing kept up until about possibly midnight, and General Blanco did take the town. They had to fight street from street, and the amount of casualties were just terrific on both sides. But the old Federals did fall, and Blanco took it for his for the Carranza forces. That evening, as the battle was still in progress, about dark, my uncle had rented a house in Laguna Vista, and there were the children of his that were my age range, and he had a car going down there, and I was invited to go. And I didn't get to go to Matamoros the following day to see the results of this long battle, or day-long battle. However, my parents went, and they said the bodies were every place. And as I understood, they took them in ox carts and hauled them out by the edge of town and tried to burn them, but they didn't burn very well. They put oil and inflammable material on them, and that created a health problem, it was said. I stayed at Laguna Vista, just where it is now, on the bay at Laguna Madre, about 5 or 6 miles up the bay from Poyas Bell. I guess we were there a week or 10 days, and by that time the whole thing was pretty well cleaned up. But I remember my father took me over there later, and we could see the bullet marks on the buildings all through the town. And the trenches were still there, they hadn't been filled. The defenders had at every street intersection, they dug trenches to defend these people, the city, from the invaders. But the invaders were too much for them. Then, as I recall, there was another battle about 1915 when Pancho Villa's forces, was it 1915? And Villa may have come, but he wasn't in charge of operations. He wasn't here, was he?
So he's,
General Rodriguez was
there. Well,
He laid siege to the city for many days, but he never took it, did he?
Not for Rocky, was the man, the general inside of it.
And that thing went on. Many of the wounded were brought across out about where Villanueva is now, near the pump station, not far from the home of Fred Roosterberg Jr. And they were brought down to some of the buildings in town. I believe Mr. Quetzal's building on 10th and Adams. And some of the local doctors donated their time. And nurses, women that had nursing training, RNs that had not been active, but gave their time. And then I think Red Cross took volunteers from doctors and nurses from San Antonio and Houston, didn't they? They came down.
I think so.
And surprisingly, a lot of these people had perforated abdominal bullet wounds, and a big percent of them got well without surgery, and even in the head, some of them got well too. Those kind of wounds today, of course, would have almost immediate surgery, or surgery as quick as they could be. Surgery would have been available. However, it was explained to me by some of the doctors that were attending, Dr. Pumarejo of Matamoros, Alfredo Pumarejo, that the local hospital in Matamoros recently been named for, was there. He was on this side, as I recall, and he attended them. When the battle was over, he came over. He was always a resident of Matamoros, and Harry Lowe and Jimmy Renfro and another old gentleman named B.L. Cole, a local doctor, and others. And they explained it that Kirkham, yes, was here too, nature just seemed to seal off these wounds, and although they did have intestinal perforations, many of them recovered. That thing, these wounded soldiers that recovered were kept out in Fort Brown for a while. They were interned there for a few weeks or months, and then finally returned to Mexico, as I recall it. They were not prisoners of war. They were just immigrants. I guess you'd say wounded. What were they classified?
Refugees. Joe, remember, we used to ride by where the guard was. That's where the PX is now. Down towards my home plate was when they played ball knocking toward the lake. And we used to see this fellow stand out there every afternoon. And they'd take him back in the guardhouse. Remember that?
Yeah, they brought him out for a retreat. They had to stand in formation.
When they lowered the flag, they had to stand in detention. Yeah. Remember seeing an old man there with a long white beard. Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, right after the war, the battle, they opened a lot of buildings here to take in the wounded. The old rice mill was taken in, and they put in a lot of wounded people in there. And my father's warehouse, right there on Adams and 11th, that was opened up, and that was a warehouse where they had a lot of wounded. And also in front of the Central Fire Station, the Fletcher Building, right there right in there, they had lots of wounded in there that I remember.
That was the Sterling Building.
That was the Fletcher Building.
That's terrible. Whatever it was, see. But they had a lot
Edgar
of wounded people
that
in there.
There was a
tremendous amount of people wounded and killed.
He went broke and he sold it to Mysterio.
You know, I wish I had thought of it. I would have brought some postal cards that I happened to have that they used to sell here years ago after the battle. You remember them, Joe? Mm-hmm. Well, I bought them and I put them away. And I happened to be looking over some old stuff and I ran into these postal cards. And it shows you the trenches and the streets of Matamoros where they did. And it shows you where the cart is coming down the street and they're throwing bodies from on top of the buildings into these wagons full of
carretas,
or I forget
what new cars. Two wheel wagon.
Listen, the Mexican government had these postal cards picked up, and you don't find them anymore today, but they were taken by a fellow by the name of Runyon. And I asked him one day, huh?
Man Runyon.
Old man. And old man Dittman took a lot of movies.
And Runyon took these postal cards, and I asked Mr. Runyon if he could get me some more postal cards, and they were all destroyed.
Mildew.
You see, but I have a few of them left that I'm sorry I didn't bring them to show them to you.
I had one of Tom Tate, Blaisdell.
I'm not that supposed to either, but I believe that.
They had four fellows at the end of a rope, one on each end of the rope.
You love it.
Huh?
One you love a lot. Whiskey makes me. Go ahead, Buck. Listen.
I had a picture of Tom Tate, and I think Tom got it from him. It was he and Blaze Denning were the only two I could remember, but there were four of them, and each one of them had a dead Mexican during the bandit raid at the end of a rope. The dead Mexicans were probably not quite as far as from here to that window out there, 20 feet from 15 feet from. And the horses were all headed toward the head of the public land. In 1916, I believe it was early in 16, the news, the latter part of 15, was cold weather. We sold our horse stock, and a man by the name of, the only one we could get to go get the stock, the fellow didn't have too much regard for personal injury or anything, followed him, Henry Harbor. And he got two vaqueros, and they went up and drove the horses back from Sebastian overland and put them in the pens over there on Fronton and Palm Boulevard. Good. And a man named Joe Ballinger, who now lives at Sebastian, lives in San Diego, bought the horses.
Is he still alive?
No,
he's dead.
When did he die?
Joe
G. Ballinger's
name.
I didn't know it.
Yep.
He lived right at the ranch that my father had at San Marcos.
Yeah, the floodway.
And I used to go see him there every time I went by. I hadn't been up there for 2 or 3 years.
He did.
So, then what happened?
And that was just about at the height of the bandit trouble. And Uncle David said that while they were gathering the horse stock, he went up with Henry Harbor on the train. they had gone over then, and he went on the train today. They had sent for him to go over to identify some horses at a ranch called Yazalon. And they went, and five or six of the horses had our brand on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and they said, well, I'm going to take these horses. And I think either Lamar Hill or some of those fellows were there. And he said, what do you want to do with the saddles? Well, these fellows haven't got any use for the saddles. You can take the saddles too. So they brought the saddles along too. And Uncle David said there were about 20 fellas dead, and they had them all lined up. Just one right along, just one right after the other. And they'd all been shot.
But I want you to tell me about the day that you all went out to your place and the bandits killed the man that was used to the care of the ranch.
Well, we weren't there when they killed him.
No. But
we got there right after. I'm saying the next day or the 2 days after. Yeah. He was still hanging in the tree.
Yeah. Without no justification for having been there.
Who? The rangers did that.
You don't?
Who?
You don't agree with that thing.
The rangers,
killed the man.
Now, Zephyr's father was in charge.
Oh.
And he was in Ireland. And when he got close to the ranch, he heard the shooting. And he went in the brush, he didn't come up. And when it got dark, he went and he got the family out and brought them to Harlingen. And the rangers left this fellow, they didn't know where they had taken him. And they take him up the road about maybe 200 yards from the house. And the other sister was the lawyer's wife, Maxine, who was involved in the duel, and she lived right where the Barreda home is on Washington Street. One, two, three corners right there.
That's another block good thing that I'll tell you that happened. You know, it was two people. The general, who is his name, Gonzalez?
Miguel de la Peña.
Fell in love with the same widow
in the island.
Maxine fell in love. Now, Maxine was a judge. And finally, Maxine goes and tells the general that they both can't live. That one of them must die, and the general didn't want to fight the duel with Maxine. But finally, they agreed to fight the duel. They tell me that Buck's great-grandfather.
My grandfather.
Buck's grandfather was one of the seconds they fought it at
he was De La Peña's son.
Yeah.
Old Man Kelly was
Maxine's
son. Agitated the thing along. Yeah.
So they went across they went across the river and they had the duel. They tell me that at the first shot, De La Peña left Maxine shoot and he missed. And that he asked him not to go, not that a woman.
Then Peña
shot him. Peña fired in the air.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second time, the guy took aim.
Well, he ran and he hit Peña in the mouth with a pistol.
Yeah.
He says, I demand the second shot. He says, it'll be my pleasure.
And then he shot him.
Shot him right in the heart and killed him. And then Kelly ran off and left him there.
I wish Kelly was there to kill him.
In those days, they couldn't bring him in.
William Kelly.
Yes, and William held him up. And they brought him from boat till they got him across over here.
No, they brought him over in the Chalan in a buggy.
In a buggy,
I was drunk. Son of Mifflin's or a grandson?
He was a son.
A son. He was a brother of John G.
John G. Jimmy was the
other. He's a champion.
Yeah, I know.
Father.
Oh. Not the Joey, not
the... Not this one that died, Ridalis.
That's all right.
No, the other.
Alfonso.
He was on that drive.
Precisely.
What happened now?
But the old man Mifflin went out there with the saddlebags full of money and bailed him out. Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson caught him.
Caught him.
He was just about to get out of the territory.
Just about at the Red River.
So the reports allege.
Right.
Who did he shoot?
He shot into the room and killed her by mistake. He thought he was shooting the other man.
They thought he was going to assassinate
Doghouse Kelly.
It was a roadhouse. It wasn't anything but a goddamn courthouse.
It was a saloon.
Batmaster and White Herb caught him and shot him?
Drowned the cattle.
Where was that there? They caught him when he was a fugitive. See, he had murdered this woman with cold blood and he shot her through the thing, thinking he was assassinating Dog Kelly.
And who was Dog Kelly?
Yeah.
Who was Dog Kelly?
He was the owner of the saloon.
Quite a figure in town.
And Wide
was a marshal, and Marshall was something else, some kind of piece.
They caught up with him right at the Red River, just about the time he was going to cross over.
What river?
The Red River.
Between Oklahoma and Texas.
They caught him in the Indian
Oklahoma. This thing happened up in Kansas.
Kansas. They didn't catch him.
This didn't
catch him until he was way down there.
I understand.
But then after he killed him, he took off and he left. You see, they were trying to catch him and they caught him when they tried to
reach the range
between Oklahoma and Texas. You see, just before he got to Texas, if he got to Texas, he'd have been there.
Yeah, he'd have had it made.
He'd have had it made.